Welcome everyone to the session today. At this time, I'd like to turn over the microphone to Marissa DiMaia with the Southwest ADA Center. Marissa, the microphone is yours.
Thank you, Robin. Hi, everyone. This is Marissa DiMaia with the Southwest ADA Center. I will be serving as the moderator for today's session. Today's program is brought to you as a collaborative effort between the Great Lakes and Southwest ADA Centers, both members of the ADA National Network. Again, this session is offered as part of the ongoing ADA Legal Webinar Series. Our session today is being recorded, and the recording will be available for review within about 24 hours of the conclusion of our session. A copy of the PowerPoint presentation for today's session was available for download prior to the start of the session.
Marissa, can I stop you for a moment? We've lost our captioner for a second here.
Sure.
Captioner, can you let me know when you're back in again? Because I'm not seeing captions from you. Hello, captioner. Can you please let us know when you're back in again? I see that you're disconnected. I'm sorry, folks. We're having to stop at this time until we can get our captioner back. We've lost our captioner, and we're waiting for them to either re-sign in or do something to reconnect. So I apologize that we're going to have to take a pause here. We cannot continue our session until it's fully accessible, and that will not be until our captioner is back available with us. Again, thank you very much for your patience. Captioner, can we just do a test at this time? I apologize, folks. We had our captioner back in, but she's not been able to connect. She's going to go out and reload and come back in again. So again, I apologize for this delay. We should be back with you shortly. Please stand by. Thank you. Once again, I apologize. We're still waiting for the captioner to be able to reconnect. So again, thank you very much for sticking with us. We will get this up and running. But until then, still hang on, and we'll be back with you. Thank you. Okay, folks, at this time we have reestablished our captioner and we will begin back the session. So go ahead, you can start again, and again we apologize. Thank you.
All right. Hello again. It's Marissa DeMaia. I'm going to go ahead and start where I left off here. Our session today is being recorded, and that recording will be available for review within 24 hours of the conclusion of this session. A copy of the PowerPoint presentation for today's session was available for download prior to the start of the session. If you were not able to access that ahead of time, you will be able to access those materials via the archive for the session, and a link will be posted at www.ada-legal.org/ within about 24 hours following the conclusion of the session. Our presenter will provide us with some valuable information today, and he's also provided a few breaks throughout his presentation to allow for questions, as we know this is a popular topic. Please follow the instructions provided to you earlier for submitting your questions to us. You will not be able to view the questions as they're submitted to me, but they will be viewable to me, your moderator, and our presenter. So feel free to submit your questions as they come to your mind during the presentation. I'm going to go ahead and begin today's session by introducing our presenter, George Powers. For those of you who may not be familiar, George is an attorney and a legal specialist for us at the Southwest ADA Center here in Houston. He provides training and technical assistance to our consumers through our toll-free line. Some of you may have called our center from time to time. You may have gotten to talk to George. He's an awesome guy. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to George.
Okay. Thank you, Marissa. I'm really excited to be here to present on this topic for two reasons. The first is that I usually have to pay someone to listen to me. But the second and most important is that this is a topic that we deal with a lot at the ADA Center. So, providing you with this information will make my job easier in that you'll be more informed about your rights. Just as a legal disclaimer, even though I'm an attorney, I'm not your attorney, I'm not your lawyer. So if you have an attorney and they tell you something different than what I do, they are correct and I am wrong. So today we're going to be talking about housing and access. We're going to talk about the rights of people with disabilities in the housing context. And the Fair Housing Act has the same definition as the Americans with Disabilities Act in relation to people with disabilities. A person with a disability is defined as someone with a mental or physical impairment that is substantially limited in their major life activities, or is regarded or has a record of such an impairment. The Fair Housing Act applies to housing providers, so we're gonna talk about their duties. And housing providers includes landlords, apartment management, homeowners associations, lenders, real estate agents, brokers, and state and local governments. The main mechanism that the Fair Housing Act uses to ensure equal access is reasonable accommodations and reasonable modifications. Okay. This brings us to our first case, which is Anderson versus City of Blue Ash. So in this case, there was a child with autism and several other disabilities that used a miniature horse in the backyard for equine therapy. The problem, however, was that the city had zoning laws that prohibited horses. The neighbors also complained of the smell and waste, so the city sought to have the animal removed. The child's mother obviously objected because the horse brought her a great amount of benefits. So they took the issue to court. The lower court, the district court, agreed with the city, and it reasoned that it was not reasonable to have the horse as an assistance animal or as a service animal. What they found was that the animal did actually create a legitimate health and public safety concern. And more importantly, they reasoned that the child could travel to like a farm to receive the same therapy and the same benefits. The plaintiff appealed, and the Court of Appeals disagreed with the lower court. First off, they found that the child could not obtain the same benefit by traveling to a farm because they would not be receiving constant therapy. By having the miniature horse in their backyard, the child could exercise and play just like every other child in the neighborhood. But more importantly is that the accommodation from away from the home, going to a farm, it's irrelevant to the Fair Housing Act analysis. And that is because the Fair Housing Act guarantees equal access and enjoyment at the person's house. So even if that child could receive the same benefit by going to a farm, it doesn't matter because that's not what the Fair Housing Act guarantees. It guarantees that you have that right, that benefit, you have the right to that benefit at your home. And then the court also dealt with the secondary issue, which was the health and public safety concern, by having an assurance from the plaintiff that she would hire a service to clean up after the animal. So the reason that I brought up this case so early is that it's important in the sense of assistance to animals, but it's also important because it illustrates that both the Fair Housing Act and Title II of the American ADA applied in this situation to a suit against a local government. The Fair Housing Act protects people from discrimination when they are renting, buying, or securing financing for any housing. And we're mainly going to be focusing on the relationship between the landlord and the tenant, so when people are renting. And we're obviously going to focus on people with disabilities. So what does the Fair Housing Act apply to? The answer is actually pretty simple. It essentially applies to all housing. And that's kind of how you should approach any analysis. Just assume that it applies. Because there are exemptions, but they rarely come up. So the first exemption is in the context of single family homes. And this comes up when a seller or landlord does not own more than 3 houses at one time, and they don't use a real estate broker. So I like to picture this as like when your friend or your neighbor, someone close to you, is informally renting you one of their houses. They probably aren't going to use a broker. But this, like I said, this situation doesn't really come up that often. In the context of multifamily dwellings, there's an exemption for when a seller or a landlord lives in a building with 4 or fewer units. So the Fair Housing Act doesn't apply when, for example, someone is renting a duplex and they live in one of the units. One important aspect of the FHA is that it has accessibility design requirements for new multifamily buildings. So newly built apartments have to comply with certain accessibility requirements. those buildings that have four or more units that were built for first occupancy after March 13, 1991 have to comply. So the design requirements actually apply to all ground floor units and all units with an elevator. So essentially, if you can access it, if you're a person who uses a wheelchair and you can access it, it should be compliant with these design requirements. So let's just do an example to illustrate a point. There's this apartment complex built about 5 years ago, in 2011. Let's call it Shady Acres Apartments. It's a multi-story building, three stories, and it has six units. There are two on the first floor, two on the second floor, and two on the third floor. There is no elevator. So the building has six units total, which means it has four or more units, and it was built after the 1991 date. So the design requirements apply. But because there is no elevator, the design requirements would only apply to the units on the two units on the first floor. HUD has created the Fair Housing Design Manual to assist builders with complying with the design requirements. The design requirements have seven accessibility elements. The first is that the buildings must have an accessible entrance on an accessible route. Public and common use areas must be accessible to persons with disabilities. All doors and hallways must be wide enough for people that use wheelchairs. All units must have an accessible route into and through the unit. All units must have accessible light switches, electrical outlets, thermostats, and other environmental controls. All units must have reinforced bathroom walls to allow later installation of grab bars. And finally, the kitchens and bathrooms must be accessible to people who use wheelchairs. Now, the Americans with Disabilities Act has a readily achievable barrier removal standard, which means that older construction must be accessible or must be made accessible when it's not too difficult or too costly. So for example, let's assume that a restaurant was built in the 80s, which is 11 years before the ADA was implemented. So the ADA design requirements would not apply. That doesn't mean that the restaurant can just stay inaccessible. The owner has a duty to make the premises accessible if it's not too difficult or too costly. So they may need to widen the door, install a ramp to the entrance, make the restrooms accessible, and so on. Now, if we have that same scenario with an apartment complex built in the 1980s, that the landlord or that owner has no duty to go back and make anything accessible, no matter how easy or inexpensive it may be. Our next case is the Fair Housing Rights Center in southeastern Pennsylvania versus Post Goldtex GP. So what happened in this case is that a developer converted a commercial factory that was built in the early 1900s into an apartment building. And then the residents there complained that the units were inaccessible. So HUD came out, they did an investigation, and they found that the units were in fact inaccessible. A suit was brought, and then the court was asked to determine whether the Fair Housing Act design requirements apply to a commercial building that was built before the compliance date that March 13, 1991 date, but later converted into housing after that date. So as I mentioned, the accessibility requirements apply to the design and construction of covered multifamily dwellings built for first occupancy after March 13, 1991. Now the court looked at the statute and it found it to be ambiguous on its face. So it could have gone either way. The statute was not clear, it had multiple meanings. So to figure things out, it turned to HUD's regulations. And the HUD defines first occupancy to mean a building that has never before been used for any purpose. So in this case, the factory was in fact used for commercial purposes. And thus, the court found that the design requirements of the FHA did not apply. Marissa, I'm going to turn it over to you to see if
we have
any questions.
And just a quick reminder to everyone there, if you have a question, feel free to submit it there in the chat area. Okay, I've got a couple of questions here. First question is, to clarify, can an apartment complex charge the tenant for, say, a ramp and doorway modifications to a laundry facility?
Yes, and that's something we're going to cover later on, which are reasonable modifications, but a short answer, yes.
Okay, and there's another question that came in. It's they're asking you to clarify. Can you clarify a bit more about single homes that are rented out? So in essence, they're understanding that a single home that's rented out, it would technically maybe not apply under ADA. Is that correct, George?
Okay, so the ADA would not apply to the single family home in any case, but we're talking about what I'm mainly focusing on is the Fair Housing Act. And the Fair Housing Act applies to most single family homes that are rented out. Not the design requirements, but we're talking about just like the anti-discrimination rules where like if you have an assistance animal, you have a right to that animal, or if you need reasonable accommodations or modifications, you have a right to those. But the design requirements that I was talking about only apply to multifamily dwellings, apartment complexes. And then, as I mentioned, there is an exemption for single-family homes, but it kind of should never think of that exemption, but because it only applies when it's like your friend renting you their home without the use of a broker. It's a very informal relationship.
Okay, one more question. Next question is, who decides what is cost reasonable to landlords?
Well, so this is what we're going to talk about later. It doesn't really matter. It matters under the ADA when a restaurant has to go back and make their facilities accessible if it's an older building. But the Fair Housing Act doesn't have such a standard. They don't have a readily achievable barrier removal standard. So it doesn't really matter. And this is actually our next topic, which is reasonable modifications. So the landlord doesn't really have to pay for those. So the cost doesn't ever come into play, whether or not it's an undue burden in that sense.
Okay.
And I'm going to explain it in more detail in our next section.
Okay.
Good question.
I know we've got a couple more in there that pertain to service animals. I do see your question, and I know we're going to get to that as well, George. So let's go ahead and move on, and we will get to your question shortly, okay?
Okay, thank you. Okay, so now we're going to talk about reasonable modifications, which has a different meaning under the Fair Housing Act than it does under the ADA. Under the ADA, reasonable modifications usually refers to a change in, like, or an exception to a rule or a policy. However, under the Fair Housing Act, the reasonable modifications refers to changes to the built environment or the physical structure. And it's important to remember that for it to be reasonable, it has to be necessary for the full and equal use and enjoyment of the housing. So some examples of reasonable modifications are the installation of a ramp or widening a door or installing grab bars in a restroom. But the more important thing is that it has to have a connection to the person's disability. So for instance, if a person uses a wheelchair and they need a door widened, there's a, you know, there's a direct connection or a nexus between that disability and the need for the modification. They're not going to be able to fit in a narrow door, and they're not going to be able to access their home because of their disability. So there's the connection. However, if that same person, the one that uses a wheelchair, wants to paint their purple door or paint their door purple, there's not really a connection between the disability and their requested modification. Painting the door purple, while it may look good, it's not really necessary for access. So this is the question we had earlier about who would be responsible for the installation cost of the modification, and that is the tenant. The tenant is responsible for the cost. So there are kind of three situations where modifications come up, and I'm going to try to illustrate those through three examples. So the first is an apartment building. Let's call it Shady Pine Apartments. This apartment was built in 1972, way before the Fair Housing Act's design requirements came into play. So it's inaccessible, but it's still compliant with the law. A person that uses a wheelchair moves in, and they want to have a ramp installed to the laundry area, I think was the question asked earlier. If they want to have that ramp installed to access the laundry area, they would be responsible for that cost. Now the second example. We have another apartment complex called Shady Acres Apartments. This one was built in 1998, so the design requirements apply. However, the builder did a bad job, they were negligent, or they just didn't care, and they did not install that ramp to the laundry area. So it doesn't comply with the design requirements. A person that uses a wheelchair moves in, they make a request to have the ramp installed, and in that case, they would actually not be responsible for the cost. They would not be responsible for the cost because it's not complying with the design requirements. It was not built the way it should have been built. Okay, now our third example is another apartment complex, which is Cypress Hill Apartments. So in this case, this was also built in, like, say 2005. It's supposed to comply with the design requirements, and we, in this case, we did have good builders. They did what they were supposed to do. So everything is compliant with the design requirements. So one of the requirements, as I mentioned, is that reinforcements on the underside of the wall, there must be reinforcements on the underside of the wall so people can install grab bars. So in this case, the person moving in, they need grab bars in the restroom. So they need grab bars in the restroom and they make that request. They would be responsible for that cost because the design requirements don't actually require that grab bars be installed, just the reinforcements on the underside of the wall. So what they are asking for goes beyond what the design requirements require. So they would be responsible for that cost. These issues usually come up in, you know, in multifamily dwelling situations where people rent in apartments or condos, and these changes to the structure, to the physical structure, can be to both to the inside and outside of the dwelling. For example, to the entrance to the unit. But they can also be changes to the common and public use areas, like the gym, the pool, mailbox area, and laundry room. So who's responsible for the upkeep cost of these accessible elements? And it depends. Like most legal questions, it depends. First, we have to look at where the modification is installed and if it's used only by the tenant. So let's say that a person has a lift installed inside their apartment. They would be the only ones using that lift. So they would be responsible for the upkeep and the maintenance costs of that lift. However, changes to the common area are usually the landlord's responsibility. So that ramp that to the laundry area that we talked about earlier, that is generally going to be the landlord's responsibility to maintain. So if there's like a crack or if the snow needs to be shoveled on that ramp, they would be responsible for it because they usually maintain the common use areas. What about restoration costs? Again, it depends. If it's a modification to the inside of the dwelling, it's up to the tenant to restore it, or it's up to them to pay for the costs. However, it also depends if it affects the next tenant's use and enjoyment. So for instance, widening doors has been found to not affect the unit's use or usability. So in that case, the tenant would not have to restore or pay for the cost of restoration. However, grab bars may affect the next person's use. So the person, the current tenant would have to pay for the restoration cost. What's more, any changes to the common areas do not have to be restored. And even if there's a duty for a tenant to restore, the landlord can always choose not to. They can choose to have an accessible unit so that when other tenants with disabilities move in, they can have an accessible unit. So once in a while, reasonable modifications come up in the single-family home context, and this usually involves disputes with homeowners associations. Homeowners associations like to keep things pretty, which can interfere with the person's right to access their home. One common example is when a person, people develop disabilities. Lots of people age in their homes, so they have to make modifications to their homes to be able to access it once they do develop these disabilities. So someone in their older age may start to need to use a wheelchair, which is actually something that is happening to one of my neighbors. and she installed a ramp to her entrance. We have a nice homeowners association, so they didn't say anything. But some might say that, or actually a lot do say, that this interferes with the theme we have going on in the neighborhood. It makes things look less pretty. And then, so to determine if their request to install that ramp is reasonable, we look at the two competing interests. The homeowners association has an interest to keep things looking nice. The homeowner has an interest to access their home. So one of those is obviously outweighs the other. So whenever it's aesthetics versus utility, utility usually wins. Another situation where reasonable modifications comes up is in the context of builders. So this is when a developer or a builder is building new single family homes and someone with a disability is in the process of buying that home. That purchaser is responsible for the additional cost. So for example, someone that uses a wheelchair is planning to buy a home that's being built. And they meet with the builder, they talk with them and request that the sink be lowered, the sink and the counter be lowered so it's more accessible. Now, if the builder were to build the sink to its sink and counter to its original specifications, it would cost $1,000. However, to build the lower sink and counter, it would cost $1,500. So in this case, the purchaser would be responsible for the additional cost for the difference, which is $500. The thing that's kind of unfair is if things were reversed, where you know, the modification actually costs less, the builder doesn't have to pass that saving on to the person with a disability, the purchaser. At least not under the Fair Housing Act. So landlords and housing providers cannot require that a person, you know, pay a security deposit for the modification. However, under some circumstances, and if restoration may be required, the two of them can agree that an interest-bearing escrow be set up. And once again, I'm going to turn things over to Marissa.
Okay,
for
everyone's
questions.
Been busy while you've been speaking there, George. We have a couple questions that came in. The first one is, so to clarify, the housing providers pay for modifications, not the tenant. Is that correct?
No. In fact, the tenant is responsible for the cost of the modification. The only time that the housing provider would be responsible is if the apartment building is subject to the Fair Housing Act requirements, design requirements, and it was not built to specifications. So one of the specifications is that there must be an accessible entrance to the laundry room, to common use areas. So if the builder, you know, did a bad job and if this unit was built after the 1991 date, then in that case, the housing provider would be responsible. But anything that goes beyond the design requirements or any modifications to buildings that were built before the 91 date, the tenant is responsible. Do I need to elaborate a bit more on that?
I think we got it, George. Okay, the next question is, Could you clarify who has the responsibility to pay for a ramp in the laundry facility at Shady Acres Apartments, where the ramp built during construction and after March 1391 did not meet the standards?
Right, yeah, in that case, the housing provider would be responsible because it's not built to specifications. It wasn't built the way it was supposed to be built. So we don't penalize the person with a disability when the builder did something wrong.
Okay. And what about buildings that receive federal funding, such as, for example, Section 8? Does that still apply?
No. Buildings that receive federal financial assistance, I'm not 100% sure, but I think they're actually responsible for the cost of any reasonable modifications. But I would need to double check.
But
okay. I'm about 95% sure.
Okay. One last question that came in is, can a housing provider request medical documentation for someone who requests a modification?
Sometimes. And this is what we're going to cover at the very end. But it's another issue of it depends. It depends if it's obvious or not. And usually the needs for modifications are obvious because, you know, there's some kind of physical impairment. So usually, no. But we're going to talk about when they may need to provide some kind of medical documentation later on.
Okay, very good. Just a quick reminder, you can submit your questions there in the chat area. And for those of you listening in, if you are not able to do that, you can email your questions to webinars@adaconferences.org. All right, George, I'm going to turn it back to you.
Okay, thank you. So the next mechanism used to ensure equal access are reasonable accommodations, which again has a different meaning under the Fair Housing Act than it does under the ADA. Usually under the ADA, this refers to changes in the work environment and usually in the employment context. However, under the Fair Housing Act, these are changes, exceptions, or adjustments to a rule or policy, practice or service that is necessary for a person to have full and equal enjoyment and use of the housing. And just like with the reasonable modifications, there must be a connection or a nexus to the disability. So one common reasonable accommodation are assistance animals, right? So most apartment complexes have no pet policies, but if you have an assistance animal that's needed for your disability, they have to make an exception when reasonable. So unlike reasonable modifications, a tenant is not responsible for the cost. They are not responsible for the cost. And then there's also no deposit required. Reasonable accommodations must be made on or be must be made by or on behalf of a person with a disability, and they must be reasonable. So this is where this dispute usually comes up, is whether or not the request is reasonable. And we have to look at this on a case-by-case basis. There's no formula. You just have to look at a number of factors and essentially the two competing interests. And then the landlord or the housing provider doesn't have to grant the accommodation if it's an undue burden, meaning if it's, you know, too difficult or too costly, or if it's usually it's too difficult administratively, it's just too difficult to implement. And then what's more, they don't have to grant the accommodation if it's a fundamental alteration. So for instance, a person with a disability moves into shady, I'm running out of examples, Shady Acres apartments, and they're unable to use, they're unable to use, you know, to drive a car, and there's no public transportation available. So they go to the landlord and they request that, that, you know, the landlord provide them with transportation to and from the grocery store. Now, because the landlord doesn't do this for anyone else, they don't have a shuttle service and they don't provide transportation to anyone else, this would be considered a fundamental alteration because it goes beyond their regular relationship that they have with the tenants. However, just because something may be unreasonable or maybe an undue burden or a fundamental alteration, the analysis doesn't end there. The landlord still has a responsibility to engage in the interactive process and discuss possible alternative accommodations. This brings us to our next case, which is Dempsey versus Housing Operations Management. So in this case, the tenant had alcoholism, and his father passed away, and he relapsed, and he began to miss rent payments. And the landlord actually tried to work with him. They set up a payment plan, which he was unable to abide by. So eventually, they tried to evict him. He argued that because of his disability, alcoholism, that he should have been excused from making rent payments as a reasonable accommodation. However, the court disagreed. They found this request to be unreasonable because paying rent goes to the very nature of the landlord-tenant relationship, and the failure to do so undermines this relationship. So this was a clear case where a request for an accommodation was, you know, obviously unreasonable. So I have a question for the audience, and that is, when a tenant that uses a wheelchair wants the carpet to be removed inside the apartment, would this be considered a reasonable accommodation or modification? And I know you guys cannot answer me, but it doesn't matter anyway because this is kind of a trick question. It depends. It depends on if there's a smooth finished floor underneath the carpet. So if there is a finished floor underneath the carpet, it would be considered an accommodation, and the tenant would not be responsible for the removal cost of that carpet. However, if there is no floor and one has to be installed, then the tenant will be responsible both for the floor's installation and the carpet removal's cost. So the Fair Housing Act design requirements have require that 2% of parking spaces that served covered multifamily dwellings be accessible and on an accessible route. However, remember that we mentioned, or that I mentioned, there is no readily achievable barrier removal standard under the Fair Housing Act. So housing providers don't have to go back and make their premises accessible. So if we have an apartment from the 1960s, they probably don't have any accessible parking spaces in the residential area Yes, and they actually do not have a duty to go back and restripe and make those spaces accessible. 2% of those spaces accessible. But things aren't that gloomy because the Fair Housing Act accounts for this, accounts for this oversight by allowing a tenant with a disability-related need for a parking space to reserve a space as a reasonable accommodation. So if someone has a need for a closer parking space to their unit, they can request it as a reasonable accommodation. And this applies even when the landlord has a policy of having unassigned parking. And then the landlord cannot charge a fee for the reserved space unless there's a generally applicable rule doing so. So if they charge a $25 fee for all parking, then even the person with a disability would have to pay that fee. It's just that the person with a disability cannot be charged an extra fee. So whether or not that space needs to be van accessible or whether or not it needs to have an access aisle depends on the facts. It depends on the need of the person with a disability. So if that tenant uses a wheelchair and they have a van that has a lift or a ramp, they're going to need a van accessible space with an access aisle. But if they have something like a heart condition and they just cannot walk long distances, they're probably not going to need a van accessible space. And once more, I'm going to tag over to Marisa for any questions.
Okay, we've had a few come in. The first one is here. If a tenant's disability has worsened and they're no longer able to live in the unit, would the landlord be required to let the tenant out of their lease as a reasonable accommodation?
Yeah, I think it's not something that HUD specifically answers, but I think they would be. And this is just my interpretation based on my experience. But the reason I say that is that essentially your disability impairs, or your disability means that you can no longer enjoy and use your dwelling. So because of your disability, you can no longer use and enjoy your dwelling. So which is what the Fair Housing Act guarantees. So if even without reasonable accommodations, like we'd have to look at if there are alternative reasonable accommodations. Like if you live on the second floor and you suddenly need to use a wheelchair, then maybe they can move you on to the first floor without charging any extra fees. But if for some reason you just cannot live in that complex, it would depend on the facts. It would have to be like a very extreme situation, usually where someone would need to be go into an institution is like the most common thing I can think of. In that case, I think that the landlord would have to make an exception.
Okay. Next question is, as an accommodation for removing carpet, if the individual has an autoimmune disorder or chemical sensitivity, would they then be required to remove the carpet as an accommodation?
Okay. Chemical sensitivities are a hard one because no court in the states has recognized it as a disability. I know that there have been cases in Europe that have. So I think that's the way the law is moving. But if you also have like an autoimmune disorder, then yes, that would qualify as a disability. And then it would depend, just like with the example with the person that uses the wheelchair, would you need to have a floor installed? Just removing the carpet, and if there's a floor underneath, then it would be an accommodation, and you would not be responsible for the cost. But if there's no floor underneath and one needs to be installed, then you would be responsible for the cost.
All right. One last question on parking. You mentioned the 2% requirement. The listener wants to know, do they have a van? Do they have to have a van accessible parking space? So within that 2%, does it have to include a van accessible space?
I believe so. And the best resource to look at would be the design manual, the Fair Housing Act design manual. There will be a link to it at the very end of this session. But it's one of those things, again, where I'd want to double check, but I'm like 95% sure that yes.
Okay, I think a lot of the other questions pertain to our next section, so I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to you to continue on.
Okay, thank you. So assistance animals, their right to have one is considered their reasonable accommodation. And assistance animals under the Fair Housing Act is a much broader term than it is than the term service animals under the ADA. And one easy way that I like to remember the difference is that people usually have more rights at their home than they do in public places. So the ADA applies to public places like restaurants and stores, where the Fair Housing Act applies to housing, your home, whether that's an apartment or a single family dwelling or a condo. So at your home, you can walk around naked all you want as long as you have the blinds closed, and I actually do that all the time. But I cannot go out in public naked because that would make other people blind. Now, service animals under the ADA are defined as dogs that are trained to perform a certain task for a person with a disability. The Fair Housing Act, and actually under the ADA, sometimes they can be miniature horses. Under the Fair Housing Act, assistance animals don't have to be dogs or miniature horses. They can be, goats, which is actually a common emotional support animal, pigs, lizards, snakes, tarantulas, anything you can think of. And they don't have to be trained. So service animals have to be trained. Assistance animals don't, which means that animals like emotional support animals or therapy animals are covered by the Fair Housing Act, but they're not covered by the ADA. Both under the ADA and the Fair Housing Act, there are no breed, size, or weight limitations unless it poses a direct threat of harm. And then this kind of depends on whether, it depends on objective evidence about the specific animal and not the speculation, and not just mere speculation. So pit bulls get a bad rep, whether rightly so or not. But lots of people have pit bulls as service dogs or emotional support animals. But the landlord cannot exclude a pit bull unless it has evidence about that specific animal that it has attacked people in the past. That landlord cannot exclude that pit bull just because, they have a bad reputation. And then both under the ADA and the Fair Housing Act, service animals and assistance animals don't have to wear any type of identification, like a vest. You don't have to carry in around any certification or registration. So the next case is Chavez versus Aber. And in this case, the tenant had a pit bull as an emotional support animal. Of course, the landlord had a no pet policy. They had a problem with the pit bull, and they tried to do everything to have her evicted. They even harassed her, and you know, they were essentially unable to evict her. So they raised her rent. So this is a clear example of where the landlord did everything wrong, and the court agreed. They denied that landlord's motion for summary judgment and found that there were plenty of facts to support, you know, a claim for discrimination. Housing providers cannot charge fees and deposits for assistance animals, so no security or pet deposits are permitted. But the tenant is also responsible for the damage to the property, as long as it's not normal wear and tear. The tenant is also responsible for the care of the animal, keeping it under control, and cleaning up after it. What about service dogs in training? So under the ADA, the rules for service dogs in training are actually controlled by state law. The ADA doesn't touch up on it. But the Fair Housing Act doesn't require that assistance animals be trained. So service dogs and training are permitted in the home, and that is only when it's for the tenant with a disability. In other words, a professional service dog trainer doesn't, and when a professional service dog trainer is training a service dog for someone else, they don't have a right to have that animal in their home, because the Fair Housing Act protects the right of the person with a disability, of the resident with a disability, not the right of the professional service dog trainer. So is there a limit to the number of assistance animals under the Fair Housing Act? No. There is no limit, but remember, this is a request for a reasonable accommodation, so it has to be reasonable. Some factors that go into it are the size of the housing, the nature of the animal, and whether or not it's a significant nuisance to the neighbor. But the most important factor is the health and safety concern. So if you own a ranch in Magnolia, Texas, and you have 10 cows as assistance animals, that's probably reasonable. But if you live in a one-bedroom apartment in New York, having those 10 cows as assistance animals would be very unreasonable. And once again, Marissa, do we have any questions?
Oh, yes, we do. So let me start here. I'm just going to dive in. Could you discuss medical documentation in support of a request to maintain an emotional support animal?
Yeah, sure, of course. Good question. So I'm going to talk about it in more detail later on. But essentially, if you have an ESA, your disability or disability-related need for the animal is not obvious. And in that case, your landlord can request information from a treating psychiatrist or a reliable third party that explains that need.
Okay, very good. Can a landlord limit the number of service or emotional support animals? Say someone has two dogs and a cat.
So it depends, right? It depends whether or not it's reasonable. First off, you're gonna need verification from your psychiatrist or reliable third party that each of those animals is needed for your disability. And then we're gonna have to look at whether or not it's reasonable. And then for those two dogs and cats, I'm not sure why it would be reasonable. Maybe if it's a nuisance to the neighbors, but it would have to be a very significant one. The biggest factor, as I mentioned, is when it creates a health and safety concern, that's when it really becomes unreasonable. But before that, it's a gray area where it depends on the factors. So short answer, no, unless for some reason it's unreasonable.
Okay, and with regards to emotional support animals, if a landlord or a landlord asks for a letter of proof, which provider is authorized to write the letter? Would it be their nurse, their doctor? Can you elaborate a little more on that?
Yeah, so HUD is actually pretty broad on this. It can even be like a social worker, but really my recommendation is when you're talking about an emotional support animal, it's going to be because you have a psychiatric disability, and you should really get it from, you know, your treating psychiatrist if at all possible, and that is because they would be the most credible source. You don't have to. That's just my recommendation. It can be a reliable third party. It can be your primary care doctor if they're treating you for it. It just the source has to be reliable and credible. There's no one right answer.
Okay, one more. You said goats can be emotional support animals, so that means someone can have a goat in their apartment or in their own home, or if they own their own home, not a farm. So that is, they're wanting you to clarify about goats.
Yeah, of course they can, as long as it doesn't create a health and safety concern. So there's probably going to be zoning laws, like that case that we talked about at the very beginning, Anderson versus City of Ash Blue, where there's zoning laws against horses. There's probably zoning laws against goats, but if you have a disability-related need for that goat and it does not create a health and safety concern, then yeah, you can have a goat as an ESA.
Okay, one more, and then I think we'll move forward. If there is a standard pet deposit required for an apartment, is this waived for a tenant with an emotional support animal? Can you clarify?
Yeah, it has to be. And so, yes, it has to be. And I don't know if I made it clear, but I guess I want to go back. Assistance animals under the Fair Housing Act is a very broad term. It encompasses both service animals, assistance animals, therapy animals, and any other animals that you may need because of your disability.
Okay.
So no fee or pet deposit for any of those.
All right. I think we're ready to move on to our next and last section, George.
Yeah. Thank you. So how do we request reasonable accommodations and modifications? There's no formality. There's no right way to do it. You can just go to the management's office and request it verbally. But obviously, you're going to want to do it in writing so that you have a record, because disputes come up. That's why we're here, why the ADA Center is here, because we get calls a lot of times about landlords not doing what they're supposed to do. And one thing they must do is respond within a reasonable amount of time. And if they don't, that can be seen as a denial of their request and can be seen as a form of discrimination. So what information can the landlord request from a tenant? Generally, they cannot request any disability-related information, but if you make a request for an accommodation or a modification, and if your disability or disability-related need is not obvious, then they can request information from a reliable source. So we talked earlier about ESAs. So that would be one end of the spectrum. But the other end is like a tenant who is blind and who uses a guide dog. So their disability and their need for that guide dog is obvious. So the tenant can really not ask any questions or cannot request any documentation from their doctor. But if a person has a psychiatric disability like depression and they use an ESA, an emotional support animal, then a letter from a treating psychiatrist, a social worker, or any other reliable third party would be sufficient. So if a person believes that their rights have been violated by their housing provider, I recommend that they file a complaint with HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, your state's protection and advocacy group, or even your local housing authority. Some good resources are the DOJ's and HUD's joint statement on reasonable modifications and reasonable accommodations. HUD's guidance on assistance animals, and the Fair Housing Accessibility First website. I think someone was talking about van accessible parking spaces. The design manual on that website will give you all those specifications. And then back to Marissa for our final set of questions.
Okay, and there's a lot of them. next, let's see, the question here is, what time frame is considered reasonable time? Is 30 days too long for a service animal, for a request?
So for a service animal, yeah, I would say so, because you don't even have to provide any documentation if it's obvious. I mean, usually with service animals, your disability-related need is obvious. So I'm guessing it's like a bureaucracy issue with the landlords, and I would say anything over 30 days would be unreasonable. Like administrative hurdles are not really a factor whether or not it's reasonable. What is reasonable is the need to seek out more information. But just red tape itself is not a good reason to delay your requests.
Okay. Next question is, do you consider medical documentation from online providers to be reliable and credible?
Well, it kind of depends. I think you may be talking about telehealth. So if you have one of their states, which I don't think there's many, maybe like one or two that does allow telehealth, then yes. But if you're talking about a website that just prints out a letter, without actually examining you, and if that's not actually your treating doctor, then no, I would not consider that a reliable source.
Okay. Next question is, when you say that assistance animals don't have to be trained, could you please elaborate on that? Does this mean they don't have to be task trained or just not trained at all?
Okay, yeah, both, right? So assistance animals means service dogs, which do have to be trained, but they also mean emotional support animals, and therapy animals, which do not have to be trained, or are not actually trained. So they don't have to be trained to perform a task. But I guess if you're talking about like house training, then yes, they don't have to be trained technically, but then you would also be responsible for all the damage that animal does to the premises. And then, as I mentioned, you're responsible for cleaning up after it and keeping it under control. So when going into the public and common use areas, it's gonna become more unreasonable for you to be accompanied by them in those areas. And then there's also that factor of whether or not it becomes a significant nuisance to the neighbors. Whether or not there's a smell, like a significant smell, and just other health issues that may arise.
Okay, switching gears a little bit here. The next question pertains to homeless shelters. As far as access to homeless shelters, are there any fair housing access and construction requirements for shelters, or would that be under 504? If they get federal funds as far as the ADA. So what if a shelter, is run by like a religious organization? Does ADA not apply?
Yes, if it is run by a religious organization, the ADA would not apply. Title III of the ADA would not apply. The Fair Housing Act also has an exception for religious organizations, but I'd have to look into it in more detail. But if it's not run by a religious organization, a homeless shelter would be covered by the Fair Housing Act and by the ADA. And if they receive financial assistance, then they would be covered by the Rehab Act of 73.
Okay, next question is, we have a consumer who is homeless. Before she came to us, she said she was denied entrance to 3 homeless shelters in our area because she has an emotional support dog. Is this legal? Must she show proof of the dog certification? And do they have to make an accommodation for her?
Okay. Yeah, as I mentioned, homeless shelters are covered by the Fair Housing Act. So, yes, they have to make an accommodation. But, I mean, the problem with certifications is that they don't have any real force of law. Anyone can go online and print a certificate. the housing provider could accept it, but they don't have to. What they have to accept is, well, what they can request is proof from, you know, like a treating psychiatrist, as I mentioned, that explains the need for the ESA. So if that person provides that information, they would have a right to have that emotional support animal in that shelter.
Okay, and switching gears again here, as a disability services office in a public university, we're being inundated with requests for emotional support animals. We've been approached by our counseling center to ask about objective measures to determine legitimate need. So when a student claiming severe anxiety has been living on campus for a few weeks without an emotional support animal living with them, how does a practitioner justify the need for this when they have clearly been able to cope without one?
Okay. Well, first off, I'm not a doctor. I'm a lawyer. But I do know a bit about this topic. So they're right. First off, the right to emotional support animals in the college context, in the universities, only applies to dorms. They don't apply to, you know, classrooms. So they have a right to be accompanied by a service dog to the classroom, but not an emotional support animal. They have that right in their dorms, in their housing. Now on the issue of anxiety, so a student could go to college and then, you know, they're faced with new pressures, so their anxiety may become more severe. And then, you know, some doctors may decide to up the dosage or change their medication, but some may decide that, you know, an ESA may be the best course of treatment. Once again, not a doctor, but I'm in that kind of the scenario that I'm envisioning and can be common, to be honest.
Okay, and this one goes back to landlord-tenant. Can a landlord require that a service animal or emotional support animal be housebroken?
So that's a tough one. I mean, it's kind of what we talked about earlier. I don't think they can, but what they can do is, but what can happen is that the person would be responsible for the damage. And then we look at, so it's a reasonable accommodation request. So we look at whether or not it's reasonable. And if that actually creates some kind of health and safety concern. But as long as the tenant pays for the damage, you know, I may need to look into it further. I don't think HUD's guidance answers it. But I would say it would be on a case-by-case basis, and it would determine whether or not it creates a health and safety concern and damage that cannot be irreparable.
Okay. I think we have time for one, maybe two last questions. Next question is, can a shelter offer to rehome or foster someone's emotional support animal as their only accommodation?
Well, it would depend on why they're doing so. Remember, they can exclude an animal when it creates a direct threat of harm. So, is the reason they're offering to relocate that animal because there's a history of that animal attacking other people? If so, then yes, they can do that. But if there's no such history and they just don't want to deal with the animal, then no, they cannot relocate the animal.
Okay, this question goes back to our discussion of responsibility in parking. Question about accessible parking in senior buildings. Can an apartment complex assign accessible parking spaces in a range or entire row and not by allowing individual designated spaces to each apartment on an individual basis? And is based on having like an accessible parking permit. As a result, some tenants who need to park closer due to mobility issues are no longer able to reserve their own parking spots located closest to their units because all tenants with parking tags now need to park on a first come, first served basis in the accessible row.
Okay, I think I kind of can picture what's going on. So the problem is that 2% of the spaces have to be accessible, serving the covered units have to be accessible, and these spaces have to be on the shortest route or have to be as close as possible to the accessible route. So they can reserve some of those spots as long as they don't go below the number that's required by the law. I'm guessing they have the minimum, so they probably cannot reserve those spots. So it would be unreasonable for them to essentially break the law by taking those spaces out and putting in reserved spots. But that being said, you still have a right to request other reserved parking spaces, even though they may not be as close as those accessible spaces. I'm sorry, Marissa, could you please repeat that question?
Sure. Can a landlord use the housing modifications as a tax write-off if they have to make any for a tenant?
Oh, that's a tough one.
I think you would have to talk to a tax person, maybe.
Yeah. I know that there are tax breaks for changes to commercial facilities. And then, no, you know what? I would say no. Here's why. Because, one, the tenant is actually responsible for the modifications. The only time the tenant is not responsible is when the modifications would have to have been there in the first place. So that situation won't really come up as it would like with a restaurant. Remember, there's no readily achievable barrier removal standard. So I don't even see that situation come up. As I mentioned, if they have to pay for the modification, that's only because they were supposed to build the premises that way anyway. And then the other case is that the tenant would actually have to pay for the modification.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying, George. Well, I think we are actually at the very end of our segment. We have run out of time. We realize that some of you may still have questions for our presenter, George. So I apologize if you did not get a chance to ask your question. If you do want to submit your questions, you can send those to us. If you have a question that you did not get answered, we'll be happy to answer them at the Southwest ADA Center. You can email those questions to us at swdbtac at ilru.org, and we'll be happy to provide an answer for you. I want to thank our presenter, George Powers, for sharing his expertise and valuable time with us today. We certainly learned a lot. I know we had a lot of questions. As a reminder, today's session was recorded, and it will be available for viewing within about 24 hours at www.ada-legal.org. We invite you to join us next January 18th, that's next year, for a review of the top 10 ADA legal cases of 2016 with Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg of Equip for Equality. For questions regarding this or other sessions in the series, you can direct those to 877-232-1990 or via email to webinars@adaconferences.org. Lastly, you will receive a link to the evaluation via email at the conclusion of today's program, as well as instructions regarding securing certificates of attendance or other continuing education recognition. We encourage you to participate and share your views with us, as they're always valued. Again, thank you everyone for joining us today. You may now disconnect your browser.